Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, it's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we are joined by a man who's a journalist and political analyst. He's a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, welcome back.
Glad to be here, as always.
We are also joined by a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, welcome back.
Good evening.
And last but not least, he's a political analyst, commentator, and editor of The Polemicist, and his latest op-ed is entitled Swedish Sex Pistol Aimed at Assange, Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
So, our first story, UK court to decide on Assange extradition to U.S. in February. A London court will decide in February whether WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange can be extradited to the U.S. to face 18 criminal charges in connection with the leak of thousands of classified documents relating to U.S. military activity in Iraq and Afghanistan. Assange appeared at Westminster Magistrates Court today by video link from Belmarsh Prison, where he is currently serving a 50-week sentence for skipping bail and fleeing to the Ecuadorian embassy in London in 2012. Let's start with Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, your thoughts on today's hearing?
Well, it's the beginning of a long process. It was, I suppose, a good thing to see that he participated a little bit today. He spoke up. He said, I didn't crack a password. I cracked no passwords when the American attorney, you know, mentioned that issue. So he was there, and he was obviously in the game and able to participate at some level. So that's a good thing. But we're at the beginning of a long process. This is, you know, they've said the next hearing is going to be in February of 2020. So, you know, and that's kind of a month before he's going to be released. His 50-week sentence is up. So between now and then, there's going to be a lot of jockeying, and there should be, and I hope there will be, more political organization in support of him. The one thing that's interesting about this, in terms of what I've written recently, the issue of the Swedish extradition, the longer this goes on, the deeper they get into this process of adjudicating the American extradition request, the less likely it is that Swedish extradition request will ever be able to get back into the game, although I don't think it's entirely to be ruled out yet.
Caleb Maupin, it's interesting to me that Assange told the London court that he had not seen the latest indictment containing the 18 U.S. allegations against him.
Indeed. And many of the reports that are coming out seem to show that Assange is not being treated very well, and that his access to information is rather limited. And I think that, you know, the lack of outrage from so much of mainstream media is really shocking, because in theory, what is being done to Assange right now and what could potentially be done to him if he's extradited to the United States could happen to any of them if they publish something that is classified. I mean, the Espionage Act charges, this would be, you know, charging him for publishing material, not for leaking material, but for actually publishing material. So this is a very, very serious case. And the way he's being treated is something that all of us should be deeply concerned about, all of us who work in media, but all of us in general. I mean, this is a threat to the civil liberties of all people. Assange simply practiced freedom of the press in the 21st century using 21st century technology. He himself didn't leak any classified information. So we should all have our eyes on this case.
Jack, Ben Brandon, the barrister acting for the U.S. government, told the hearing that the 18 charges covered one of the largest compromises of classified information in the history of the United States, and claimed that Assange's actions have created a grave risk for human intelligence sources, including human rights defenders. Part of the problem with that statement, as far as I've been able to discern, is that the United States government has never provided any information, proof, or support to substantiate that claim. And so if the United States is successful in extraditing Assange back to the United States, this to me would seem to wind up being having an incredibly stifling impact on journalism, even the four of us having this conversation on this program today.
Yes, well, who knows where it actually will lead in the long run here, but they're going to use the whole issue to really push the envelope on, what they can use to go after people. I think this is, really what's one of the things behind this, to broaden that all out and to use it as an expansion of the whole idea of quelling free speech and making people wondering what they can say and not say. And, at the same time, there's this growing attack on academia and people in research and so forth that's just beginning here. And I wonder if we're going to see with China and technology working on the same projects, working on the same contracts and so forth. Very clearly, the government is trying to make anyone in the U.S. who's working with any Chinese scientists or investigators or researchers here in the U.S. To think twice about their relationship. It's all part of the whole long-term trend here of making people worried about what they say and what they can do and not do. It's a big chilling effect. And I think they're just going to milk this thing for as long as they can and make him a symbol.
I'm really glad, Jack, that you mentioned the academic side of this, because it's not a stretch to go from attacking and pursuing journalists to attacking academics. In fact, I remember Liz Cheney had her mother had a conservative organization during the Bush administration that was going after what they deemed to be liberal academics.
Yeah, well, Trump is using this national security idea to do all kinds of things. And, like you say, it's not a stretch of the imagination to think about, is he going to pick on a few scientists who are working in some universities with Chinese colleagues on some sort of engineering or something and make an issue of them as well? I mean, if you're going to broaden the whole idea of what is national security, very easily it could go there. And I think, they're going to use national security and pump up this Assange trial and everything as a scare tactic. I mean, that's part of it. It's not everything, but that I think that's part of it. They'll use it to a kind of, 21st century McCarthyism of sorts.
It was Lynn Cheney and I think it was the American Enterprise Institute that was going after professors that they believe to be too liberal. Jim Kavanaugh, speaking from prison, Assange asked the court to clarify the U.S. allegations that claim he cracked a password on a U.S. Defense Department computer network. He insisted he had not hacked any password and defended WikiLeaks as nothing more than a publisher.
And as far as I know, the indictment doesn't say he did crack a password, because he tried to, or he suggested some ways that Chelsea Manning might try to crack the password. So the indictment, as I understand it, doesn't even contend that he did crack the password, just that he made some suggestions about how you might go about doing that, or where you might look to find ways to do that. Even that, it might even have been that indirect.
What that statement indicates to me is that he may not actually clearly understand the charges against him. It appears from this, he may not have been able to actually read the indictment. And again, going back to one of the earlier comments, he told the court he hasn't seen the latest indictment. So how can anybody participate in their defense, and which is supposed to be one of the fundamental elements of a legal proceeding, is the ability to participate in your defense? That to me just seems to be greater evidence that he doesn't even really understand all that's going on around him.
Yeah, this is exactly, and it's particularly troubling and infuriating, since the only thing he's in jail for in Britain now is this bail jumping charge. There is no reason that someone in jail for that charge should be in solitary confinement, in maximum security, not able to see, have visitors or lawyers visit. Clearly, he has not been able to participate in his defense. His lawyers have been saying that. And that is, it really is kind of outrageous. And Caleb is absolutely right. And there was a video I saw today of a demonstration in Britain in front of the court where a journalist, an alternative media journalist, was speaking, and he addressed, he said, all of the newspaper, all of the journalists who were around him that day, you know, were the ones who have been attacking and vilifying Assange for 7 years. And they're the ones who should be in the forefront of being outraged about this. And they should be. That's right. And, you know, this is just that very fact. I mean, what is a guy who's in jail for a bail-jumping charge being, you know, locked up and away from his family, away from visitors, away from his lawyers 23 and a half hours a day? That's not a bail-jumping charge. Clearly, they are already treating him as someone who's guilty of horrific crimes.
And Caleb Maupin, final point and question to you. A lot of people listening to this program might be asking themselves, why are we spending so much time talking about Julian Assange? Why does this matter? Why do we spend week in and week out covering every new development on this issue? And to me, the answer is very simple, because it cuts to the very fundamental elements of democracy, and it cuts to the very fundamental elements of our Constitution.
I would agree with that 100%. It's very sad. You know, this mantra of Julian Assange is not a journalist. We're hearing that from the mainstream media quite a bit. Well, I didn't read in the U.S. Constitution anywhere it says freedom, there shall be freedom of the press only for real journalists as declared by mainstream media. Whatever gripe you have with Assange, you don't like some of the stuff he said on Twitter, you don't agree with him, you don't think this, you don't think he should have released that, that's not the issue here. I mean, the issue here is freedom of the press in a very, very clear, straightforward way. He did not leak any classified material. He is simply being charged with publishing what was handed over to him by other people. He is not a citizen of the United States. I mean, there's so many levels of danger here. And that the precedent set by his case is very, very dangerous. And there has been a little bit more alarm than there was initially. But at the end of the day, everyone should be deeply, deeply concerned about this. I mean, the way that this case rolls out and the results of this, are going to have implications for every person in the United States and really everyone around the world. I mean, in theory, you know, someone on the other side of the world could publish something on the internet and then be extradited to the United States and put in prison for it. I mean, that's absurd. I mean, that's not a world we want to live in.
And the journalists with the New York Times and other publications that have won awards using the information that was provided to them through WikiLeaks, they need to turn in all of their awards and renounce the financial remuneration that they've received for having won those awards if they don't understand the significance of this case. And sticking with the Constitution, the Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal of a man who has been held in wartime detention for 17 years with no end in sight. The Supreme Court on Monday refused to hear a lawsuit by a Yemeni man, Mo'at Hamza Ahmed Alawi, who has been held in wartime detention in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, for more than 17 years. And this prompted Justice Stephen Breyer to warn that the American legal system is on autopilot toward permitting life imprisonment without trial. Quote, "It is past time to confront the difficult question left open by a 2004 ruling allowing the indefinite detention of Guantanamo detainees captured after the 2001 American invasion of Afghanistan," Breyer wrote in a statement about the denial of the request to hear Mr. Alawi's appeal. What has happened, Jim Kavanaugh, to the Constitution and to the Supreme Court? None of the justices, from what I understand, with the exception of Breyer's dissent here, want to touch this thing.
Yeah, they're giving the preference to the government on this as a national security issue, as an issue of war. They declared that, you know, really what they're challenging is the authorization of military force. Can it still apply now, 17 years later? And they're saying ultimately that's a political decision that we don't make. They're kind of recognizing the authority of the government. This category of illegal combatants, you know, who aren't really prisoners of war, but, you know, they're in this bizarre state, this kind of limbo state where they can be held forever. And he's right. And Breyer is good. I'm glad that he's doing it. This is something that's absolutely right. Do we allow indefinite confinement of people we designate outside of a kind of the normal, even the normal prisoner of war system, as illegal combatants whom we can hold until we think it's okay to let them go? And, you know, again, of course, this goes back to Obama's refusal to honor his commitment to close Guantanamo and bring them into the normal judicial system. Either they're prisoners of war or they're not. Or they're criminals, and you bring them in the normal judicial system. But there is a challenge to the politics of the Congress and the political parties and political personages. The authorization for military force should be repealed, and it's going to be used against Iran. And even though, you know, there's no, it's not really justified, but once you get one of these things on the books now, again, it's not really the declaration of war. It's some kind of something else that doesn't name a particular country, but names a certain set of conditions under which we can still say we're fighting a war. So it's very bad. And it's not just a judicial system, a problem. It's a political problem. And it has to do with the relation between the judiciary and the political process. But I'm glad that Breyer has pointed it out.
Caleb Alwi did not challenge accusations that he served in a Al-Qaeda militia helping the Taliban fight the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. He also did not concede that that was true. Instead, he argued that the legal basis for holding him as a wartime detainee had unraveled because so much time had passed since his capture and because the conflict in Afghanistan had changed. But an appeals court panel disagreed, and only Breyer was interested in taking up this appeal. So we hear all this discussion about how important it is to vote and that Supreme Court justices are the lasting influence and impact that a president has. And, you know, we thought that Obama appointed justices like Kagan would be more liberal than others. But here we find Breyer is the only one willing to take up an issue that cuts to the core of the United States Constitution, detention without trial.
The sad thing about this is that it may actually be a good thing that the Supreme Court didn't take this up. I mean, as sad as that may be, it's almost better for the Supreme Court to say nothing on this case than to say something bad. I mean, you know, if they were to have a ruling, which if you look at the way the court is now, I mean, it's definitely a conservative court, and there's a good chance they could hear this case and say, you know what, holding someone indefinitely for 17 years, even though the situation in Afghanistan has changed, even though they have had no trial, you know, that's fine by us. And then that would be solidified, and we would have an even worse ruling from the courts than we had in 2004. So, I mean, that's the sad reality. I mean, habeas corpus, I mean, just basic, you know, holding people indefinitely without charges, you know, obviously that's the kind of thing the U.S. Constitution was set up to prevent. But at the same time, you know, we have a court that would probably like to, you know, to solidify that. So maybe the fact that they didn't take the opportunity to hear this case and then give a Supreme Court ruling that would make this absolutely acceptable, maybe that's the better outcome than what could have occurred, as sad as that sounds.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, I know you've heard the adage, and I won't go through the whole thing, but the adage being they came for the communists and I said nothing because I'm not a communist. They came for the Catholics and I said nothing because I'm not Catholic and blah, blah, blah. And then eventually they came for me and there was no one left to speak. Again, man, I think a lot of folks here are overlooking Julian Assange because he's not an American citizen. He's not right now being detained in this country. And it's not getting the attention that it deserves, even though it is a direct frontal assault on our Constitution. We're not hearing an awful lot about Mr. Alawi because he's a Yemeni and he's being detained in Guantanamo And the thought is that he's an enemy combatant. But again, this gets to the very core of who we are supposed to be as a country. And we rationalize a lot of our international interference on the pretext of we're spreading democracy at the barrel of a gun. This is incredibly hypocritical and nauseating.
Well, the operative term here is enemy combatant. You know, it's declaring somebody an enemy combatant rather than a prisoner of war that allows them to deny any rights, any legal rights, any civil rights to this person. And, you know, that's the crux of all these folks stuffed in Guantanamo. And it's also at the crux of enemy combatant. Can they take that term and then apply it to born or naturalized American citizens? They came awfully close to that, and in some cases actually did that, you know, way back during the Iraq days, if people remember, enemy combatant. If they can use that term to apply it to American citizens, well, then they can treat them the same way they're treating those in Guantanamo. Denial of your basic citizen rights, the basic right to a trial, to charges, to defend yourself, all the other things that we fought a revolution for way back in the 18th century. You know, those were fundamental rights. But this whole concept of enemy combatant, when they start applying that term to U.S. citizens in a, we could imagine a crisis situation here in the U.S., right? Where we're moving in constitutional crisis directions, we could have a decade or even less from now, we could have actually, you know, a serious situation of Americans, citizens, you know, rising up and protesting and being declared enemy combatants by those who are in power. In other words, a Trump on steroids who doesn't care about running roughshod over the Constitution or the institutions of government, and we see him move in that direction already, they could easily apply that precedent concept. It's a precedence that they're using, you know, with Guantanamo and all these conflicts around the world right now, that they could easily just drift over and apply it to American citizens in imaginable situations. Then we've got, you know, George the Fifth or whatever it is back in 1777, 78, all over again.
I remember, and we'll take this out here, I remember interviewing Gore Vidal a number of years ago, and he was talking about the war on terror. And he said, the war on terror is such a nebulous term, it might as well be the war on dandruff. He said, neither of them make any sense. He said, but the war on terror is an awful lot more dangerous, and that it will morph into something so egregious that we won't be able to control it. And unfortunately, Gore Vidal may have wound up being more prophetic than he even understood. Folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and it's Friday, so it's panel time. So we're joined by Jim Kavanaugh, Dr. Jack Rasmus, and Caleb Maupin. Gentlemen, thank you all so much for staying with me. Trump rejects Iran's denials that it attacked tankers, citing video released by Central Command. Two petrochemical tankers in the Gulf of Oman came under suspected attack early yesterday amid soaring tensions between the U.S. and Iran. One of the two ships attacked, a Japanese-owned tanker, was targeted just as Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was wrapping up a high-stakes visit to Tehran to commemorate the 90th anniversary of the relationship between Japan and Iran, as well as to work as an emissary to help to cool hostilities in the region and potentially mediate U.S.-Iran talks. Now, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blamed Iran for the blatant assault on the vessels and said the U.S. would defend itself and its allies against Iranian aggression in the region. President Trump rejected Iran's denials today that it attacked two tankers in the region, insisting in a television interview that Iran did do it and pointing to a video released by the Central Command purporting to show Iranian vessels retrieving an unexploded mine from one of the damaged ships. Caleb Maupin, can you say Gulf of Tonkin?
The allegation against Iran here is preposterous, okay? So we're to believe that when the Prime Minister of Japan is visiting Iran and talking to Iran about how to try and preserve the nuclear deal and being very friendly to Iran, at that moment they choose to then attack a Japanese petrochemical tanker. That doesn't make any sense. And furthermore, the other oil tanker that was hit belongs to John Fredriksen. And John Fredriksen is a Norwegian oil tycoon who is one of Iran's longest friends. And there's a biography of John Fredriksen that actually refers to him as the Ayatollah's lifeline. I mean, he goes back to the 80s. He has been a longstanding business partner of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So why in the world would Iran lash out and attack two of its you've got Japan while the prime minister is there. You've got one of their oldest business partners. Furthermore, why is it not being reported and emphasized in American media that the first on the scene was an Iranian ship with the 44 crew members? They start, and I mean, you don't attack somebody and then provide them with medical aid. If you're trying to harm somebody, you harm them. You know, the whole narrative is just falling apart. And, they've got the video. Iran did this. This is just preposterous. It really is. The notion that Iran would do this, it doesn't fit the facts. And, the more you look at the purported story, the less sense it really makes. Now, we've also seen that there have been some contradictions. Japanese company that owned this petrochemical tanker has come forward and that their version of events does not match with the Pentagon and the Central Command's version of events. So there's a lot here that is just not really adding up. So this notion that Iran, out of the blue just attacks, I mean, this story doesn't add up and it doesn't sit well. It's pretty preposterous, actually.
Jim Kavanaugh, as to what I understand, I think Japan is Iran's second largest oil importer. And to Caleb's point, Iran search and rescue teams picked up 44 sailors from the tankers, and they took them to the port of Bandar Abbas, I believe. 11 were Russian, 11 Filipino, one was Georgian. And can you say the sinking of the Maine?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is... It's almost too much, and they're not. I don't know how they can pursue it. People see through this. People are thinking that right away. This is a false flag. You know, this is something that they're going to the Gulf of Tonkin. They're going to the sinking of the Maine. They're going to the phony stories about incubator babies, and all of these things, WMDs in it. And it's like Assad is gassing his own people the day that the chemical inspectors arrive. As Caleb says, the idea that Iran would ruin its relationship with Japan, which it's trying to make more positive and keep the oil flowing to them, the day the prime minister of Japan is there is kind of, they have to be nuts. I mean, either, there's some faction of the Iranians that is bent on undermining Iran's diplomatic relations with other countries, or there's some faction of somebody else. And it's amazing that when you read the American and you watch it on television, the media coverage of this is, well, why would the Iranians be doing this? Maybe so there's some faction of the Revolutionary Guard. They never discuss who else in the region has an interest in this. Saudi Arabia has an interest in this. Israel never mentioned. Israel wants the United States to attack Iran. They want to up the ante here. Don't mention that the British sent a special SMS team the other day into Iran for some reason.
Wait a minute, Jim. When they show the film, and I watched this morning on a number of different outlets, and the narrative was you see, here's the boat, and there are Iranians in the boat, and they're pulling up next to the ship, and they're taking off a mine off of the side of the ship. How would they know that the mine was there unless they were the ones that planted it? And they never say in the entire conversation, well, maybe they saw it as they were coming up to rescue the sailors, and they realized, we don't want to work around a ship with an explosive device that is on it, so we're going to remove the explosive device so that everybody can be safe. Is that a plausible explanation, or am I just making stuff up?
No, you're not making, that's perfectly plausible. Plus, the video itself is something out of, you know, Ghostbusters.
Right.
Ghost Hunters. When did they get this? And there's no other video? They give you this all the time. They'll give you an image that's out of context, and you don't see either the full field of view, or you don't see the before and after in the video image, and it can be very misleading.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, let me ask you, as a political economist, I understand that after the oil crisis in the 70s, that a number of countries started creating oil reserves to protect the markets in case of a situation like this. But understanding that, is there going to be, or could there be, a ripple effect? I know that that oil futures, I think it is, have gone up as a result of this, but how long before we start to see an impact from this at the gas pump?
Well, probably never. You know, basically, what's happening now is that global oil prices are beginning to turn down again. You know, they collapsed about 40% almost last year. There's been around a half of a recovery, and now they're turning down again. But when you have incidents like this, it sort of puts a floor on the decline, and it's not perhaps a coincidence or a lack of a coincidence that this is happening. Crises like this are, I think, have a relationship to politics. And, you know, more importantly, you know, not only Japan, but Taiwan and South Korea depend heavily on this oil from Iran. I think this is an issue to create a precedent and an excuse for the U.S. Navy to get involved to interdict tankers going into selectively, tankers going into the Gulf. I think this is a cover and an excuse, and don't be surprised if we don't see the U.S. Navy becoming active, more active. Of course, they're very active. They got the biggest naval base, I think, or air base on Bahrain. So we have a big presence, you know, the U.S. does in that whole area. But I see this as a way of an excuse to bring the Navy in there to impose enforcement of the sanctions.
Caleb, the owner of the tanker says that the Trump administration is providing false information about this attack. He says that it's false information about what happened. The ship operator said flying objects that may have been bullets were the cause of damage to the vessel rather than mines used by Iranian forces, as the U.S. has suggested. Yutaka Katada, chief executive of the Japanese company operating the ship called Kokuka Courageous, one of the two vessels attacked, said the damage could not have been caused by mines or torpedoes that are shot underwater, since the damage was reportedly above the ship's waterline. Now, I guess folks could pull up next to the ship and stick mines on the side of the ship, but he's saying it didn't happen that way.
Yeah, and like, let's look at the wider situation. We had Pompeo announcing that the United States was intending to reduce Iranian oil exports to zero, right? That was the announcement, right, that they want Iran to not be exporting any oil, and they tried. They tried to enforce that, and, you know, a lot of countries just kind of turned around and said, well, we're going to keep importing Iranian oil, so, you know, take that, Trump. And so now we're to believe that Iran, in a situation in which it's difficult, in which the White House is essentially trying to stop them from exporting their oil, trying to stop anyone from buying their oil, they would then unleash an attack against those that are defying the White House and still buying their oil. I mean, Iran's economy depends on oil exports. I mean, the state-run economy of Iran, I mean, it's largely centered around the state. And those oil exports, that oil revenue, that is the basis for so much of what the Islamic Republic of Iran has accomplished. And so why in the world would Iran shoot itself in the foot? I mean, by attacking people that are buying its oil in a situation where they're desperately fighting for the right to keep exporting their oil. I mean, it's beyond me. The whole situation does not add up. I mean, there's just no motivation there. But there is clear motivation for other forces, and not simply forces that would want to get the United States involved, but forces that see Iran and its oil exports as a competitor. I mean, that's a very oil-rich region. You know, every ounce of oil, every barrel of oil that is bought from Iran is not purchased from Saudi Arabia, is not purchased from United Arab Emirates, is not purchased from Kuwait. Iran has a lot of competitors in the oil business right around there who would have a real interest in going after people that are doing business with Iran, and therefore not with them, or at least not to the degree that they're doing it with Iran. So there's a lot of folks who have a motivation to do something like this. The Islamic Republic of Iran is like the last person would have a motivation to carry out such an attack. They say, que bono, right? Who benefits when a crime is committed, you know? And Iran is like the last person that would ever benefit from an attack on an oil tanker belonging to John Fredrickson, their oldest business partner, or an oil tanker belonging to Iran or belonging to Japan. At the very same moment, the Japanese prime minister is in the city. It was in the city of Tehran actually meeting with the supreme leader. There's no rhyme or reason to this. I mean, this story just doesn't add up. There's no motivation here. I mean, everything about this, I mean, if someone was a crime novelist or a detective, I mean, they would really have to scramble to come up with a narrative where Iran would in any way benefit from doing this.
You know, Jim, I wasn't there, and I haven't talked to anybody who was there, so I don't know what happened. But to Caleb's point, this just doesn't make sense. And so people listening to this conversation or people reading this and watching it on television, they just need to very simply ask themselves, does this story make sense? But the final question I want to put to you, I think we talked about this yesterday, Pompeo says now that he's going to take this to the United Nations Security Council. And I get the sense that if they do, they're going to be laughed out of the UN Security Council the same way they were laughed out of the Security Council when they tried to bring Venezuela in and tried to rationalize and justify the coup attempt that the United States has been trying to develop to overthrow Nicolas Maduro.
Wow, yeah, that would be interesting. It's going to be another Colin Powell moment, I guess. They're going to, except instead of the drawings of the pictures of the trucks full of chemical weapons, they're going to show that, you know, Ghostbusters video of this wacky, this ghostly ship doing something ghostly to this tanker. But so I don't know what they're going to do about that. But the thing that we really got to, you know, this can't forget here is somebody is doing this. This is the second incident like this that's happening.
Right.
I think it clearly shows an intention from somebody. Keep at this until they get the reaction they want. And I suspect it is something like with Jack, who said they want to close the Strait of Hormuz to Iranian shipping. And they want to, you know, but this is very, very dangerous. I mean, the only argument that would put the Iranians doing something like this is that they're trying to show the Americans, look, we can screw things up if you want. But under the circumstances of this visit by the Japanese and who was attacked and everything, that doesn't hold up very much here. But it does, in fact, show that you know, somebody can screw this situation up very badly and create a problem that's going to ratchet itself up to more and more conflict and more war very quickly.
Trump elevates Poland at the expense of Germany with troop decision. President Trump announced an expanded military relationship with Poland on Wednesday as President Duda was at the White House, including the likelihood of additional U.S. troops serving at what Trump called a world-class new Polish base, which rumor has it they would name it Fort Trump, as his administration rewards a like-minded and increasingly authoritarian NATO ally. Poland says it wants to buy 32 F-35s, I think they're about $90 million a copy, and drones and all kinds of other weapons. Dr. Jack Rasmus, understand that Donald Trump is a transactional kind of guy. We've got the $8 billion deal that he's trying to push through Congress so he can sell $8 billion worth of weaponry to Saudi Arabia. And now we've got these F-35s, again, $90 million a copy per plane. Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex, and this really just seems to be Donald Trump selling weaponry all around the world, and it doesn't really seem like he cares who he sells to and what he sells them.
Well, you know, the president, and he's just the latest result of this, is the number one salesman for the defense industry, particularly for the aircraft industry, military aircraft industry. And they go around, and they have been, Obama did, and Bush before him, and now, you know, Trump, closing deals, these multi-billion dollar deals to sell U.S. arms. And, you know, of course, we saw that. You've mentioned it with Saudi Arabia. Huge, huge deal. But there's other countries, India and others, that these deals have been struck with. And, you know, Duda, the Polish prime minister there, or president, I'm not sure, you know, he's a kindred spirit to Donald Trump. You know, then they really hit it off. And that's the second advantage. You know, the third advantage is Trump is poking a thumb in the eye of the Germans because the Germans won't go along with him, though, to shut down the gas pipeline from Russia. The U.S. Wants Germany to shut down that pipeline and buy U.S. natural gas, of which the U.S. has such a surplus now. It wants to sell it more abroad and also props up prices at home. So, you know, there's a big debate going on in Germany whether Germany has to build a liquid natural gas port and buy more expensive American gas or continue with the pipeline. So they're killing a couple birds with one stone here, you know, and that's another way to, you know, play tit for tat with the Russians with regard to arms trade and so forth. But I think it's really as much of a stick it to the Germans as it is to, you know, sell more military equipment. A lot of that military equipment, by the way, that goes into the aircraft is Boeing made. So, you know, Boeing's in trouble because of the MAX, 737 mm-hmm. MAX. So, you know, you'll give them a quick shot. And all of his payments, see, never really comes from, you know, these countries. It's credits given by the U.S. government, and the money never even leaves the U.S. It goes right from Washington into Seattle.
It's a shell game or a Ponzi scheme. Caleb, to the point about German buying Russian natural gas, as I understand it, a lot of Polish homes are heated by Russian natural gas. And so one of the other, from what I've been reading, one of the other elements of this whole deal is that Poland will cancel contracts that it has with, in terms of buying Russian gas, and start buying U.S. natural gas.
You know, when you watched Trump with Duda, it was like you were watching a used car salesman or something. I mean, that meeting was not about, you know, relations between two countries, Poland and the United States. And it was about money. It was a business meeting. And, you know, Trump, you mentioned the natural gas. Trump hailed the fact that Poland is going to be importing 2 billion cubic meters of liquefied natural gas all the way from the United States. Right. He hailed the Baltic Pipe project where they're trying to connect. And he emphasized that he likes the fact that Poland's, quote, diversifying its energy sources, i.e. buying less and less from Russia. And, you know, I mean, the most comical thing that I saw that came out of that meeting was when, you know, Trump was emphasizing how excited he was that Poland might be buying more than 30 F-35 military fighter jets. And so you have, you know, Trump arranges for one of these F-35s to fly over the White House on the sunny afternoon. And you've got President, you know, you've got Duda from Poland waving, you know, at this plane that's flying above. I mean, it was like a sales meeting. I mean, this was, you know, like a realtor showing a house or a used car salesman taking a family around. I've got a very fancy one for you right here. Oh, I believe it. This is the best car you've ever seen. I mean, this was marketing and sales. I mean, it was particularly bad. I mean, the whole meeting just struck you as the United States is trying to make money here. A lot of corporations, be it military corporations, fracking companies, natural gas, energy companies, trying to make money here. It was a business financial meeting. And, you know, it's been mentioned that the Polish government is very authoritarian. And I must say, you know, if the government of Russia were to respond against, you know, its dissidents, the way the government of Poland has been treating its dissidents, it would be all over American media. There's a former member of the parliament there, Mateusz Piskorski, you know, he's been locked up, accused of espionage groundlessly. They've been particularly vicious to the Communist Party of Poland, which has a long history. We'll remember that Poland was a Marxist-Leninist country, and there's a long tradition there. And, you know, I mean, the Polish Communist Party has been rather harshly persecuted. And as the USA has escalated its military presence, there have been a lot of Polish folks that have said, hey, there's nothing in it for us here. This is not in our interest. We ought to get along with our Russian neighbors. And those folks have been dealt with authoritarian manner in which their free speech has been pretty harshly suppressed. And you will see nothing about that in American media. So, you know, the whole relationship there, the whole thing just strikes you as very, very cynical. I know a few years back there was a private phone call that was leaked in which a Polish government official who has praised the United States and talked up, at that point was talking up the Obama administration. A private phone conversation was leaked to the press, revealing how he really feels, which he really feels that Poland has gotten the short end of the stick when it comes to relations with the United States and being part of the NATO coalition.
And Jim Kavanaugh, Mark Sloboda was on the program a couple days ago and made what I thought was incredibly astute observation when he said that this was really more for domestic consumption in Poland for Duda and being like-minded as Trump, in that he said, you know, when you look at the NATO expenditures for the European countries, few of them, if any, are meeting the 2% requirement because none of them really fear that Russia has any intention of attacking anybody anytime soon. He said the one thing that Vladimir Putin is not is suicidal. So this really seemed to be more for domestic consumption than meeting any type of real military need.
Yes, I think it's for domestic consumption in Poland, anti-Russian sentiment, and in the United States, as everybody's saying, for the benefit of the defense industry and the defense contractors. We're going to get a huge windfall from this, and the military-industrial complex. Now, but it is part of a series of things that are very provocative to Russia, and Russia would be very upset with a permanent American military base in Poland. And that's why it's interesting when you look at the details of that. They're saying Trump started out with put 4,000 American military soldiers in, and then it was down to 1,000. And it's really 1,000 that are going to rotate through from Germany. So they'll take 1,000, they'll send them to Poland, and they'll bring them back and send another 1,000. So they're trying to minimize the real military impact of that. But I don't think we should dismiss the fact that the Russians are going to see this as another provocative move that's inching the American military much closer to Russia. They don't want to see a permanent American military base in Russia any more than the United States would want to see it in Mexico. In Mexico, there hasn't been a massive attack through Mexico as there was through Poland on the Soviet Union. So, you know, this is something that we should, you know, it, on the one hand, it's theater and it's a sales meeting, but it's another encroachment and another ratcheting up of serious military provocations against Russia.
Let me just quickly touch on this. I sent you all John Kiriakou's piece, Bolton's Long Goodbye, where he writes, "I'm one of those people not at all unique in Washington who has contacts and friends all over the political spectrum, including in the administration. After work and drinks, people like to vent. What they are telling Kiriakou privately is what other Washington insiders are telling the conservative press. the White House and especially the National Security Council are in disarray, and Bolton will soon be fired. Caleb Maupin, your thoughts.
Bolton is a neoconservative. And, you know, as much as the Trump White House has very much followed the neoconservative script in its policies, the fact that Trump was the nominee of the Republican Party was a repudiation of those politics, and that those politics are not what your rank-and-file Republican in a red state wants to hear. I mean, if you want to understand neoconservatism, think about Leo Strauss, right? Hmm. Philosophy professor, Chicago, who was influential, Paul Wolfowitz. A lot of these folks studied under him, learned how to understand the world from him, you know, and he would always talk about the show Gunsmoke, the old cowboy show, that he was his favorite television program. Why? Because the good guy wore a white hat and was all good, and the bad guy wore a black hat and he was all bad. And Leo Strauss basically got his students, who became the neocons, to understand that that's how average Americans should come to understand the world. You've got to dumb down politics. You got to get Americans to think about the world in terms of all good, all evil, all black, all white. And typical Americans are sheep, and you just have to kind of program them with a narrative, with a Hollywood narrative of good and evil. And that worked out pretty well. I mean, the Reagan presidency, you had a cowboy actor actually elected president. And you know, we had the Bush administration. And the neoconservative formula worked very well for the Republicans for a long time. However, when the economy crashed in 2008-2009, when average Americans were losing their homes and jobs, when the standard of living was decreasing, that formula of politics stopped working out for the Republican Party. And John Bolton comes out of that school of foreign policy thought and of messaging, and you know, he's there. He's very well connected, but he doesn't represent the way the Republican Party has shifted really since the disaster of the Bush administration. And I think that the idea that he may soon be out is reflective of that more than anything.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, we have about 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, I think it's partly a personality conflict between Bolton and Trump. You know, both are very stubborn, and Bolton is trying to run, and so far has been running, foreign policy. Trump contradicts him now and then just to let him know that, hey, you know, I'm still here. This isn't philosophical neoconservatism. This is 21st century U.S. Empire expansion neoconservatism. And, you know, when Trump first gets into office, it's kind of a compromise administration. He's got Tillerson. He's got the generals in there. He's got Gary Cohn and so forth. All of them have left or been thrown out, driven out for one reason or another. And in the vacuum, the neocons have gladly stepped in. You know, Bolton, Miller, Abrams, Lighthizer, Navarro, all these guys are running foreign policy now, and they're aggressive. They're big risk takers, as we saw with Iraq. And, you know, they think they've got control of this, but it rubs up against Trump once in a while. Hey, wait a minute, I'm the big dog here. You know, I say this. So I think if he's on the way out, it's largely because of personality conflicts between the two, but you'll just get a Bolton 2.0 in there.
Oh, my goodness. That's frightening. That's really, really frightening. I'm sorry, Jim, we've got about 30 seconds.
Well, I agree that if Bolton goes, it will mainly be because he rubs Trump the wrong way. And you will get someone else who will push the same agenda, the neocon agenda and the anti-Iran agenda. And this is being pushed from Zionist imperatives. We can't forget that. That was behind all of these wars, and from Iraq to Libya and Syria. And it's going to be behind the war against Iran. And whoever comes, Trump is putty in the hands of the militarists, and he is complicit entirely with the Zionist program for the Middle East. And so whoever's coming in is going to push Trump the way the neocons and the militarists have pushed Trump since he came in, whatever he said during the campaign and whatever the Republican base wants.
Jim Kavanaugh, thank you very much. Dr. Jack Rasmus, thank you as well. Caleb Maupin, thank you. Look forward to having you all back right here for the panel next week. Hey, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Facebook people, thank you. Greatly appreciate it. Hope we served you well. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.